Shalom Aleichem. Welcome to our annual pre-Pesach webcast. Recorded from the world headquarters of the Orthodox Union in Lower Manhattan, we again have the privilege and the schus to be in the presence of the eminent OU Poskim, Rav HaGaon Rabbi Yisrael HaLevi Belsky, Rosh Yeshiva Torah Vadas, and Senior OU Posek, and Moreno Rav HaGaon Rabbi Herschel Schechter, Rosh Yeshiva V'Rosh HaKolel of Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, Senior OU Posek. We are again, thank God, joined by my dear Chaverim, Rav Eli Gerstein, recorder of OU Psak, who works hand-in-hand with the OU Poskim regularly, and my dear chaver and colleague, Rav Elio Farrell, who works closely and consistently with me on OU educational program and projects. In particular, take note of the almost 170 kosher tidbits that have been posted on OU Radio. The most recent last week of Herschel posted a superb summary of all that relates to the halachos of Yashon. I thank all of those that have sent in questions that has given us time to amply prepare, and also urge those who have not as yet sent in their questions to do so either during the webcast or as in the past. Please feel free to email to us and the OU Poskim will respond between now and Erev Pesach Imir Teshem. I also want to urge all of you, if you have the time, to look back to previous OU Kosher webcasts on Inyone Pesach. There are several that deal extensively with issues of koshering and with many other of the issues that we may not necessarily focus on today. And allow me the personal prerogative to say a special hello to my grandchildren in Modi'in, Israel, Yonatan and Nachum. I hope you enjoy the webcast and listen closely to the Rabbonim Gaonim, who will answer the many shilas that have come in. We'll begin with some issues relating to Bedikas Chometz of Schechter. If one is spending Pesach in a hotel and he will be doing a Mechiras Chometz of his entire home prior to the night of Bedikas Chometz, what are the obligations of Bedikas Chometz prior to his departure and on the night of the Bedika itself in the hotel?
The Gemara says that if one is leaving his apartment within 30 days before Pesach, he's obligated to do Bedikas Chametz. The correct thing is he should do Bedikas Chametz on the whole apartment. If he doesn't plan to be there, he doesn't have to make himself crazy the way people do when they plan to stay in the apartment to be machmer and every little thing. But he still is obligated to do Bedikas Chametz. It's not proper to rent a whole apartment to a nochri before you leave in order to pater yourself from the mitzvah b'dikas chometz. That's a harama. In the normal course of events, I would not rent my apartment to a nochri. It's not for rent. That's a harama to pater yourself from a mitzvah. That's not proper. That's not correct. Some have a practice. The Mishnah Berurah quotes this. Some have a practice that they'll rent, let's say if you have 15 rooms in your home, so some will rent 14 of the rooms to the Nochri, and they'll only leave one room, so they'll do, at least they'll do Bedikas Chametz on the one room. Okay, so at least they didn't do Harama to pater themselves completely from the obligation of Bedikas Chametz. If you do Bedikas Chametz prior to Leil Bedika, this year Leil Bedika is on Monday night, so there are different opinions. The accepted opinion of Shulchan Aruch is that whenever one does Bedikas Chametz,
Sunday night
is Bedikas Chametz. So if one, Monday night is Yom Tov already. So if a person does Bedikas Chametz prior to Sunday night, then the accepted opinion is that one does not recite Brocha. So if one is leaving before Sunday night and he does Bedikah, let's say Matzoi Shabbos or Thursday night, whenever, he should do a Bedikah, at least on the one room that he's not renting out to the Nach, he should do Bedikah without a Brocha. But he should do a proper Bedikah. When he gets to the hotel, he's obligated to do a bedikah in the hotel room. If he'll be there, leil bedikas chametz, he should really say a bracha. Just because the workers were cleaning doesn't necessarily mean that they don't always clean sufficiently to satisfy the requirement for bedikas chametz. So he should bring in some chametz. He should bring some cookies with him, and make sure that he has chametz in the room. So then he'll be able to do bedikas chametz with the bracha in the hotel room.
So just to reinforce that, Shaila Rav Shechter, somebody asked similarly, but a little bit of a little different angle. What is the correct procedure to follow if we're going to our children on Sunday, the day before Bedikas Chometz, or that evening will be Bedikas Chometz? Do we do a search at home, or wait until the next night in our children's house? If we wait, how does one search in someone else's house? When do we say the bracha? Most of you have responded, but just to reinforce it.
If they're leaving on Sunday, so the proper practice should be they should do Bedikas, they're leaving within 30 days before Pesach. Sunday is mamish, right before Yom Tov. They should do a bedikas chametz on Mitzvah Shabbos without a bracha because it's not the lil bedika, and they should do a proper bedika. They don't have to go with all. If they plan to come back in the middle of Chol HaMoed to their own home, then they should do a bedika that, like make themselves crazy like they would do if they plan to be the whole Yom Tov. If they plan to be away for the whole Yom Tov, okay. So you do not a superficial bedika. You just do the bedika according to the din to look for the chametz and shayt. Then when they get to their children's home on Sunday night, so they should help out their children, do bedikas chametz. Could be that the bedroom that they'll be sleeping in by their children will be a mokum shem achnisa by chametz. Okay, so if you have a room where no one ever brings in any chametz, then you don't require bedikas chametz. If you have little children, it's hard to say that there's a room where you don't bring in any chametz. The children will take cookies, the little babies will take cookies all over the house and nash everywhere. But if you have adults, if the grandchildren are not little babies and they don't take cookies all over, so it could well be that the room that the parents or the grandparents will be getting will be a room that doesn't require any bedikas, right? If it doesn't require bedikas, there's no problem. If it requires bedikas, so they should be present when the children say the bracha and the children begin the bedikas, and they should go make the bedikas in their bedroom, in their room.
Before I ask Rav Belsky, Shaila, a number of our listeners, we, Baruch Hashem, have been on the webcast for several years now, and several of our listeners wrote to me asking the Rosh Yeshiva if they can please translate any word that may not be fully understood by someone who is not a Ben Yeshiva. So I would ask you to accommodate them. Is there an obligation, Rav Belsky, the night of Bedikas Chometz, to travel from Brooklyn or from Muncie or from wherever to perform Bedikas Chometz in one's office in Manhattan? And also, what is the halacha if one owns a summer home or a bungalow home in the country? Is there an obligation of bedikah, and when is that performed?
Yeah, there's definitely an obligation of bedikah for an office, but to say that it's bedikas chometz by night, it's probably not so. And the reason for that being that the takon of having bedikah done the night before Pesach, the beginning of the night, is because that's a time when Bnei Adam Mitzuyin Bevoteihem, people are there in the house, and it's also Oir HaNeri's Yofel Abdika. The second Oir HaNeri Yofel Abdika means when the candle that we use, which is the best tool for Abdika, or perhaps people would use a flashlight, and in certain places it's much, much safer not to carry around a lit candle. But L'chol HaPochus, the beginning of the night, is the ideal time for being Boidik because of these two reasons. The second that I mentioned is because the light of the candle, or the equivalent of that, is most effective. And the first is that it's the time when people are Mitzuyin Bevoteihem, when they're in their homes. People come home from a day's work and they davened already, and they come home and they do bedikas chometz. In the office that they work in the whole day, office buildings are very often closed and it's surely empty, nobody's there. It's definitely not a mokoim, a zman, rather, b'shoshem, b'nayodem, mitzuyim, b'vateihem. And it's not the ideal time for bedikas chometz. And taking the expression of Chazal to its full and applied meaning is that if they have to go out and make bedikas chometz at a time when it's not bonsui, so the bedika probably would be rushed and improper, and it wouldn't be effective. They shouldn't make the bedika, and do the cleaning beforehand when they are in the office. They'll be metzuyim bevoteihem, and they should look at very carefully, just like they do it in the bedik at home. Of course, I mentioned earlier, Shechter mentioned that there's a requirement of makom shemachnisen by chometz. People do keep food all over the office. They bring lunches and food for snacks. So there are a lot of places which are makom shemachnisen by chometz. If someone wants to put aside, I'd like to add a neufech to what was said earlier. If one wants to put aside a room so that they could be yoitza with the mitzvah bedikas chometz, and they sell the rest of their apartment or rent it or whatever, if they want to do that, they should make sure that the place that they set aside is a makom shemachnisen by chometz. Because otherwise they didn't accomplish anything at all. They were boidik in a place which is potter from bedika, which you don't have to make bedika. And the ether with the bedika is nothing. It's just for show. And the place where the which is bedik, machnisim b'chametz, very often is just as difficult to be boidik in as the rest of the apartment. They might not be accomplishing much as far as effort and time goes, but they definitely have to set aside at least that one room that's a makom shemachnisen. As far as the summer bungalows go, if they left the summer bungalow more than 30 days before, and 30 full days before, and there's no chiyuv v'dik at all at that time, then it's sufficient to... It's sufficient to be mevatel the chometz, unless they come back to the bungalow during Pesach, in which case they would have to travel out there and make bedikas chometz before Pesach. If they're not going to travel out to the bungalow, or wherever it is that they're not going to travel out, then not mechuyev to make the bedika unless they left within 30 days of Pesach. That's a very important thing to remember, because there are special Shabbosim that people come out for a simcha. They go out to the bungalow colony. Today's bungalow colonies very often are heated and equipped to be used during the winter.
Rabelsky, is one obligated to perform bedikas chometz in rooms that were cleaned for Pesach? If the answer is yes, does this include areas where there are Pesach pots, dishes or food for Pesach already stored there?
Again, this was answered, addressed by Rav Shechter. If a person cleaned the room, which he has to clean, the Rosh says that you have to clean the house before you make bedik. You can't be boidik a place which is dirty. If there's garbage piled all over, bedik is worthless. You have to be able to go into the clean home and be boidik. Someone might ask in that case, well, who needs to be boidik? You already cleaned it. The Teretz is the cleaning is not done lohir haner, right? It's not done with the same intensity and, we have absolute focus on every little spot, which chometz is usually put into. And unless you go around with the lohir haner during this very special time, that's ideal for bedikas chometz. I spoke about that before. However, if there are closets which every single thing is removed from and are completely exposed and there are no churin who stuck in, there are no holes, there are no small confined areas, and well, one might just, miss seeing a piece of chometz and it might come out on yontif. If there are no churin who stuck in, hidden places, and the closet is was completely emptied and seen with a strong light, a daytime light, or a room that's lit up with electric lighting, which is truly the equivalent of the Oir HaChama. I think Gemara says, Aksadros l'Oir HaNivdekes. It could be examined using the light of the sun, if the light of the sun shines directly on the Aksadr. If that type of bedika and cleaning was done, then you don't have to do it all over again. Otherwise, the closets where the chometz materials were taken out of, and it was completely clear and lined with paper and all that that we're so familiar with, and then filled with Pesach kelim. How could we even take a chance on putting Pesach kelim there if we're choshesh, if we're afraid that there still might be chometz left in the closet, which we didn't notice because we didn't use the Ohr HaNer? I think that the reason for it is because, like we said, Aksadr Lo'irin of Dekes, it's open and there are no Chur Mustokim. But if there's any place at all which requires getting on your hands and knees or bending down or examining very carefully, and even if you think you did it, but you didn't do it Lo'ir HaNer, so then the only real clean, real Bedikah is done after the cleaning is over, when you're able to get into these places and notice every little thing, and that's the time of Bedikas Chometz.
So, as far as Chorim with Sadokim, Rav Schechter, someone asked, as a follow-up to what Rabelski just said, is there any point in looking into cracks in the floor during the Bedikas Chometz? In other words, is that what is referred to as Chorim with Sadokim?
I don't think so. In America, I don't think so. Maybe in Europe, there were a lot of cracks, and the little children would hide things in their cracks in the floor. In my apartment, when we had little babies, they never hid anything. We didn't have too many cracks, and there wasn't any place to hide anything in the floor. I don't think those are the cracks that the Talmud is talking about. Mm.
Rav Belsky, someone will be staying in my apartment, she wrote. It's not me. What does she need to do in terms of checking and removing chametz, and what can we sell?
What could you sell? I mean, we spoke about it before. To sell, go ahead and sell the house, sell this closet, sell the chametz that's in the crack, sell the chametz that's stuck to the kelim. Some people sell blius, taste of chametz that's absorbed into the kelim. All these things are difficult to understand. Let's be kind and call it that. You sell chametz that pirurin loy chashivi. That's what our Gemara says in the Bavli. People quote the Yerushalmi pirurin memela batli. Little tiny crumbs and cracks are they're not over on them. They're not considered to be chametz in the house. However, when we're in the house on Pesach, and when there are places that are going to be used the whole Pesach long, so then you got to check to see that the tiniest crumb shouldn't get into a spot which you would put down Pesach food there. So you got to clean the best you can, and you have to wash it out or cover it and so on. But generally speaking, you just clean the chametz thoroughly and make bedikas chametz. Now, the guests who are going to use the room will use certain closets. Hopefully, they'll be polite guests. Otherwise, you wouldn't have invited them, and they would not go peeking in places that they shouldn't be peeking. So you can't tell them to take out all the stuff in your private closets and examine it. But they should, you know, perhaps be notified, or at least something that everybody understands, without being notified, with to which areas they're going to use. And all those areas, they should be boidik perfectly well. If there's a closet with private things there, then it should be closed up and doesn't have to be sealed, because it's a mokum shein mechnizim by chametz, we'll assume, and they don't have to be worried that a child put chametz in there that's not their asik. They're only renting or being given as a, you know, b'she'ila, a free rental to the places that they're expected to use. And those places they should check very carefully.
So Rav Belsky said earlier that obviously before the Bedika we assume that there was a thorough cleaning of all of the places where chametz has been held during the year.
Yeah, you're supposed to clean it. It's more of a chiv.
Chiyuv, correct.
Obligation.
That being said, Rav Schechter, I want to read exactly the way this question, this person that sent in the question, the way she phrased it. I believe it was a she. I would like to pass along a question to the OU webcast. It seems that every year in preparing for Pesach, it takes me exactly as much time as I can possibly squeeze in to prepare. If I have more time, I end up doing more detailed work and just repeating and re-cleaning areas. Is there a way to know when I have cleaned enough? And someone else phrased it a little bit differently, how far Yisrael Kedoshim Hem go in terms of cleaning for Pesach? Yisrael Kedoshim Hem means that Jews are very meticulous in adherence to the halacha.
Person has to be reasonable. He's not obligated to do anything ridiculous. The Shulchan Aruch says the custom always was that the Jews went a little bit above and beyond, and they would clean up the house even more than is really required. But it has to be within reason. A person doesn't have to make himself crazy. The Talmud tells us that on Friday afternoon, late in the afternoon, everyone is always running for Shabbos, whether it's a long Friday or a short Friday. Everybody's always running the last minute. Everybody likes to prepare for Shabbos and for Yom Tov, but one should be reasonable not to overwork themselves before Pesach so that they'll be able to enjoy the Seder. Just have to be reasonable.
Pavelski, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, well, it's one of the hardest decisions in life to know when enough is enough. If you take Bochrim, who learn a sugya in the Talmud and the Gemara, so if they'd be given an extra couple of weeks to look at the same Amud Gemara, they'll continue examining the same Tosfos and the Rishonim and Achronim and just go without a stop until someone comes along and says it's time to move on. Making a decision is requires a certain degree of leadership and, I guess, in personal behavior, some internal leadership. But you got to make that judgment. It's a judgment call. It's not the same for everyone. I remember when my children had a box of tiny elbows. And those things never get spoiled. You could wash them off in a second and cook them up, and you'll have delicious chametz in the pot. And they played with them all over the house. This goes back a long time. They have grandchildren already, some of them. And there was elbows wherever you could find it. So my Dikas Chomis that night took me about 3-4 hours. And when I was completely finished, and finished in more ways than one, and exhausted, so I looked at one tiny spot where there was a little earth underneath the last staircase going into the cellar. And I cleaned that thoroughly as well, looked into it with the candle, and then, as I was about to leave, I noticed a glint, and there was a New York City subway token. At that time, they cost $0.50. And so I took the token, and I thought to myself that it was a simon min ha-shamayim. Chazal say, man de sayer nichse mashka chistira. A person who checks his property finds a nistira. Nistira is $0.50. And it's printed, it's minted locally. The Rambam says it's made of base metal and it's minted in the city instead of from the country. Therefore, it's a large coin and it's only worth $0.50. I thought that the subway token best fit that description. And so I felt it was a notice, min ha-shamayim, that I did an adequate bedika down to the last second. But b'derech klal, usually you don't have to go that far. The house is clean, and you have to check peripherally if there are no children and places that are, you know, 3 tefachim high off the ground and not on top of the high places where you wouldn't be putting things there. Literally, mekaymes shemachnisim b'chametz, places where you keep the chametz. But you have to look. You have to be serious. You have limits on both sides. Here we have people who are, they just go on and on without a stop and cleaning and being bothered. And you have people who are very peripheral. They would spend weeks examining the newspapers to find the most ideal vacation spot and checking on it every which way. And they're spending just a couple of minutes gathering up the 10 pieces which they put out for Medikas Chometz. So, of course, you got to do a good job and not a limitless job. And it's a judgment call, and everybody has to make judgment. That's part of life.
Rav Shechter, if I work for a company owned by Goyim and do not work on Chol HaMoed, how well do I have to clean my desk area?
If I'm leaving the office within 30 days, which I'm probably doing, I should. I'm not going to be there on Pesach, so I don't have to go crazy. But still, I should check for the chametz without a bracha, because I'm leaving before Leil Bedikah. Shouldn't be that difficult. The whole desk will take 2 minutes to check the whole desk, all the drawers, and then the surface.
This question just came in. Again, I want to reiterate, if anybody wants to still email questions to Rabbi Farrell's email, please do so. If we don't get to it, we will respond after the webcast. Hopefully the webcast will be posted today, tomorrow, and those who are not able to watch live will be able to benefit from the enormous amount of Torah and Halacha that is being learned here. This question just came in, Rav Shechter, if one does not sell real chametz, must one also not sell ketchup, mayonnaise, and other such type foods?
No. One has, Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to encourage not only the students in the yeshiva, but even the balabatim, even the people in his community, they should avoid selling bread and cake and cookies and elba macaroni and so on. But ketchup, that's not chametz bien, that's taruvus chametz. Taruvus means if you have a mixture that you have a little bit of, you have an ingredient of chametz that's less than 50%. So taruvus chametz, everybody relies on mechiras chametz for that.
May one store sold actual chametz in the door of a refrigerator that contains also Pesach food items if the chametz is properly, effectively covered with paper and taped?
Well, you have a problem of tiltul. You're not supposed to move things. It becomes mukta if a thing can't be used and if it's osir. So you shouldn't be forced to open and close the refrigerator door every time you do that. You're moving chametz on Chol HaMoed. There's no mukta. There's no osir tiltul. It's not forbidden to move chametz around. If they could be put in the back of the refrigerator and sealed off in a way with that they're sort of hidden completely, then one would be able to do it. In addition to the Isser Tiltel, moving the door, opening and closing it, and thus moving the chametz on Yom Tov and Shabbos, there's surely a problem even Chol HaMoed, because there's no Isser Tiltel on Chol HaMoed, but it's surely a problem because the Gzeir of Shema Yovel Oichloi. Tosa says that the main reason for being by the Chomus is Shema Yovel Oichloi. You might come to eat it. And you move something back and forth the whole day. And it's quite likely and quite possible that you'll forget yourself and take a little nip of this delicious stuff that you've left over. And if it wouldn't be delicious, you wouldn't have left it over. So, of course, it should be hidden and put away completely.
Rav Shechter, is it preferable to burn the chametz after the Zman Achila on Erev Pesach or to burn the chametz early in the morning on Erev Pesach?
In the Shulchan Aruch, it says that if a person davens in the early minyan, he can burn the chametz all the way early in the morning. The only question is the Shulchan Aruch was written in the 1500s when they didn't really have the widespread practice of mechiras chametz. Of the rabbis selling the chametz for the balabatim today, it's a little questionable. There are those who argue the point and say that since the rabbi is not going to sell the chametz till after the time that you're no longer allowed to eat the chametz, you have an hour when the chametz may not be eaten, but it still may be muta b'hano, he may still use it. So that's the hour, that's the window of time when the rabbi sells the chametz. So some argue the point and say that it does make sense to burn today. It does make sense to burn the chametz in the morning after the 6 o'clock minyan. I'm going to burn the chametz at 7 o'clock, what do I accomplish? But I burn 1% of the chametz, and 99% of the chametz I still have. The burning of the chametz, some argue, should be the last thing you do. After the rabbi sells the 99% of the chametz to the non-Jew, So then you burn the last bit of the chametz and you fulfill the mitzvah of dashbis. So that's why many have the practice that since they rely, most people do rely on the rabbis selling the 99% of their chametz, so they want to save the little bit of chametz that they want to burn till the last minute after the rabbi sold the chametz.
Rav Belsky, we're moving to Inyanim of the Seder itself, as well as the Haggadah. One asked Rav Belsky, how is one to determine the shiur of matzah and maror on the Seder night? If one has difficulty drinking wine, how much water may be added to the cup of wine in order to dilute the wine? And also, what is preferable, diluted wine or grape juice?
Well, to determine the shiur, you're supposed to have a kezias for each shiur. Ideally, a person should be eating 5 kezasim of matzah during the Seder. In the beginning, we're supposed to eat a kezias from the whole matzah and another kezias from the broken matzah. So that's 2 kezasim. Later on, you have to have another kezias for korach, to wrap the mor inside of. So that's the 3rd kezias. At the end of the Seder, you should have another 2 kezasim. The one zecher le carbon pesach, and the other one is for the matzah, which is eaten according to some rishonim, comes from great authorities. It's the main mitzvah of the whole night, is to eat that last kezias of matzah. Now, we also have a very famous dispute, a machlokes between poskim who held that the shiur of kezias is larger. The rishonim give us shiurim for kezias. It's actually never spoken about clearly in Chazal. They told us the kezias is the size of a certain olive. There are larger olives and smaller olives, and there's one in the middle that's called the kezias aguri. The size of that olive is the shiur that we use, the amount that has to be eaten when it comes to Pesach or other times when we need to know that shiur. Now, Rashi says that it should be about the half the size of an average egg. The Rambam says about the third of the size of an average egg. There are those who, because of various questions, and they wanted to say that the eggs today are smaller than the original egg, and therefore, in order to have full-size kezias, so you have to have, according to Rashi, not a half an egg, but a full egg, and it would come out that every kezias is the size of an egg. If you want to make this chumrah, generally speaking, we're not medagdic. We don't try to have a kezias that large. If a person ate a food and he wants to make a bar nefoshes or an alamichya because he ate a kezias, he can't do that with less than a kezias, so then a half an egg is surely good enough. But when it comes to being mekayim, the last of all the mitzvahs of eating which were left to us, today there's no longer the performance of the mitzvah of eating truma for kohenim or ma'aseh sheni in Yerushalayim for Yisrael, or karbonis, kachim kalim for any Jew, or kachay kadoshim for kohenim. There's no longer any of these mitzvahs. And what about the mitzvah of ma'aseh behema and so on and so forth? And because we have this one last mitzvah in the Torah, one last mitzvah of biblical origin, which is to eat the kezias of matzah. We try to put in all the chumras we can and make it the largest kezias. Now, it would seem, therefore, that we have to have the size of 5 eggs. That's quite a bit. And don't forget, after that, we have to have the morer twice, right? One for the mitzvah of morer, one for the korach, And then we have to have, and before that, we have to have karpas, and then the shnei tavshilin. We have to have a solid meal. So how do we get there hole into our stomachs? Moshe Zatzal said that if we take an average size, because it's the size of a half an egg, for the first two kizes, half an egg each. So we'll have one from the whole matzah, one from the broken matzah, and together it'll amount to one super large kizes, which will be good enough for all the opinions, for all the shitas. And so at least we'll have one super kizes in the beginning and one super kizes at the end. And for Korach, which is only a zecher l'migdash, a remembrance for the Beis HaMikdash, so for that, it's good enough to have the small size kizes. So we could get away with five half eggs. Makes it a lot easier. Now, how do you measure five half eggs? So there are people who come home and they have these pieces of cardboard or whatever it is, and they say the average matzah, you measure so many inches by so many inches. I'll tell you how I believe almost everyone measures the kizayas. They eat what they feel is a kizayas, and then they eat a little drop more. That's how you measure a kizayas. But bear in mind that it should be the size of a half an egg, ideally. And if you're of such a size that you could swallow down five giant kizesim, well, tovei alecha brocha.
What about the wine, Rebelsky?
The wine is like this. There's many different shiurim on the night of Yehuda. Shiur, the larger shiur, would come out that a revius, which is an egg and a half, would come out to be close to 6 ounces. And according to others, it would be close to 3 ounces. So we try to use sort of a middle shear. The Mishnah Berurah in Hilchos Shabbos says that if we have a chashuv of a mitzvah, especially Kiddush Friday night, which is deraisa, to have the kiddush and to drink wine is close to a deraisa. So we have to have a larger shiur. And the larger shiur he gives is the revius, which is somewhat in between the two shiurim. And the Chofetz Chaim says he arrived at it by measuring the molei lugmov of people who, the average size person, and he computed it and came out to a shiur which is about 4.2 or something like that, ounces, 4.3. So it's a shear just in between the 2.9 ounces and the 5.7, 5.8. Those are the extremes of the other shear. If a person is able to, they should try to drink a full revius at each kois. If not, then roiv is most of revius, 51% is good enough.
The gentleman also asked whether diluted wine is preferable to grape juice.
Right. So the thing is like this. The many authorities, including Moshe Feinstein, many authorities said that it's always preferable to have wine for the Seder, for those who can, for those who don't get sick over it. And why is that? Because the Gemara says that a shosa yayin chai is yidecheres layotza, if you drink Yayin Chai, which is raw wine. What does raw wine mean? At the time of Chazal, they would dilute the wine. They took all the wine and put a lot of water in the wine. They drank somewhat of a punch, or a type of a lemonade drink. I mean, it was lemon. It's a wine type of drink, but it had a lot of water in it. Now, we're told that they had to do it because the amount of the strength of the flavor of the wine was stronger in those times. But be that as it may, that's the way they drank wine in those days. Now, so all the wine was diluted. But to the people living in those times, this was the way they drank wine. That was the way they drank wine. This was wine. So if we put in a lot of water today, so it reaches a point earlier, before this, three times as much water as wine, at which they did in those times, it'll come to a point where it'll lose the Shem Yayin. It won't be called, nobody will think of it as wine. Nobody will feel it as wine. It has to be a drink that people consider wine, and it's sweet and pleasant. Lufi das ha-shoyse, that's what the Rambam's Lashon is. So you could put in a little water into the wine. They have wines with low alcohol content. And some people feel the pleasure of drinking wine even when they have the very low alcohol content. 3.5% seems a little bit too low for a person who enjoys drinking wine, but that's probably the percentage of alcohol there was in the time of Chazal. If a quarter of 14%, which is the full fermentation of wine, so a quarter of that is exactly 3.5 ounces. But you're supposed to have l'chatchila wine and not grape juice because it has to be yidei cheiros yotze, for anyone who enjoys it, of course, and who could take the wine. And cheiros is you have to feel the happiness and the celebrating spirit which you get when you drink the wine with alcohol. It's not exactly the same. I just want to make a point of it. When Chazal said, Shosei Yayin Chayis Yidei Chelos Al Yotza, they didn't mean Yayin Chay grape juice. They meant wine, which was had 14% alcohol, just the opposite. It means there was too much alcohol for the taste, for the type of drinking they had in those days. Now today, people each one has their taste. Some people go out and buy wine for every Shabbos, which has 7%, 8%, 10%, 11%. You have every single number that you could have, between 3.5 and 14. So a person should drink the wine that he can. If they can't, then it's just too much, even a small amount of alcohol, so drink grape juice. And maybe it'll be called Yidei Cheiros. Cheiros, I saw people trying to drink a Revius, and of course the largest Revius imaginable, and every single day on Chalamoid, because you're supposed to have Simcha and Timi Mekayim, the mitzvah of having with Samachta B'chagecha, so you should drink wine once during the day and once during the evening. So I saw a fellow with a large cup to get the maximum Revius, or the strongest wine, and literally torturing himself and trying with every ounce of strength that he had to drink down that you know, huge cup of wine. I asked him, what are you doing it for? So he says to Pimakayim, the mitzvah is samachta v'chayecha. It's very, very interesting.
Was he very happy afterwards?
I'm sure that he was definitely relieved afterwards. The question is, was he happy while he was doing it?
Yeah. Rav Schechter, I will be conducting the Seder. Must everyone recite along with the leader of the Seder, or can they just listen? And also he wants to know, is it imperative for everyone to recite the Achila requirement of Pesach, Matzah, or Mora?
I don't think it's necessary for each person to say the Haggadah. The Talmud tells us that in the days of the Gemara, in the yeshivas, the students would remain behind and they would have siddurim, and the head of the yeshiva would recite the Haggadah. They didn't have printed Haggadahs at that time. That was before Maxwell House Coffee distributed Haggadahs. So they had to recite the whole Haggadah by heart. The Haggadah is part of the Torah Shebal Peh, so it wasn't yet permitted to be written down. So the head of the yeshiva would recite the whole Haggadah from the beginning to the end, and everybody would be in fulfillment of the mitzvah by listening, just like we do by Kiddush and Havdalah. I don't think it's necessary to say the Pesach Matzah Mor either, but they have to pay attention. They have to understand what when the person is reciting the Haggadah, the people don't understand Hebrew, so they won't be yotze even if they say it themselves. They should recite the Haggadah in a language that they understand. In fact, in Shulchan Aruch it says that the Haggadah should be recited in English. It says explicitly because there were Bali HaTaisus who lived in England, and they said their wives and their children didn't know Hebrew. They didn't understand Hebrew. So in the Shulchan Aruch, the commentaries quote that they recommend one should recite the Haggadah in English so the wives and their children will understand.
So many of those old agodas also have a comment prior to Rabbi Gamliel Yomer called Shlomo Shlosh Dvorim Lebe Pesach, that the women should be coming in then, that everyone should be around the Seder table. So that's just being present and listening. It has nothing to do with the recitation.
The women have to pay attention. The men and the women are obligated in the Haggadah. Everyone has to pay attention. So the women sometimes are in the kitchen, so they'll miss certain sections of the Haggadah. So they shouldn't miss the main sections. There are certain parts of the Haggadah that are not that important. And other parts are very crucial. So the Matzah Zushan Oroch L'mal Shemot, that's very crucial. So for sure the women have to pay attention. Everyone has to pay attention at that time.
This gentleman, he wrote his question with a little bit of, shall I say, feedback from our wonderful webcast of last year. So I'm going to read it exactly, Kiloshono. He said, last year there were a lot of questions about what is required as a base minimum for reading the Haggadah, especially when there are small children at the Seder. While it is good to get the answers given were very technical, often using Hebrew terms to describe the different parts of the Seder. As such, I couldn't follow the answer. Please, this year, the Rabbonim should give the answers in simple English. Not all of us went to Neri Soil. So my question with a simple answer, please. What parts are absolutely required at my Seder will be my wife and I, my mother, my four children, ages 17, 5, 2, and 1, signed by the gentleman who asked the question. So could you answer him simply, Rav Shechter?
Which parts are absolutely necessary, indispensable? Okay. You have to have the four questions. Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelos. Okay. Then you have to have Avodim Hayinu. The Talmud tells us there are two texts that they had the practice to recite. So we recite both. In some communities they said one. In some communities they said the other one. Our practice is we say both. So the one text is Avodim Hayinu Lefarbim Mitzrayim. Used to be slaves and God saw to it that we were freed. The other text is Mitchilo Avdi Avodah Zarah Hayah V'Seinu, that years ago, before the days of Avraham Avinu, our ancestors, before Avraham Avinu's times, worshipped Avodah Zarah. V'achshe Kerbana Hamokim L'Avodosa. So these are crucial. You have to have Kiddush, of course. You have to have the cup of wine, the second cup of wine. You recite a bracha. You have to say the first part of the Hallel before the meal, second part of the Hallel after the meal. In fact, the commentaries on the Talmud tell us that the second half of the Hallel, which is recited after the meal, is the more important part. Many people, after they recite the Birchas Hamazon, after they finish the meal, and they recite the Birchas Hamazon, they call it quits, and they don't bother to say, or they don't pay attention to the second half of the Hallel. That's more important than the first half of the Hallel. At the conclusion of the second half of the Hallel, you have to recite a bracha. You have to make sure there are different versions what bracha is recited. You have to make up your mind whether you are a Sfardi or an Ashkenazi. The Hasidim usually daven nusach Sfard, so they, if you're a Chassid or if you're a Sfardi, you have to make sure you have a Sfardi Haggadah. And if you're an Ashkenazi and not a Chassid, make sure you have a nusach Ashkenaz Haggadah. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi, it's a little bit complicated, which bracha to recite at the end of the second half of the Hallel. All the songs that we recite after we drink the fourth cup of wine, those can all, if you really you don't want to recite it, that's not really part of the Haggadah. That's not really part of the Seder. Chad Gadya is not part of the Seder, and Echad Miyadea, who knows one, who knows two, who knows three, Vamartim Zavach Pesach, Vachim Bahi Bach Tzea Lailo. All the piyutim, all the songs that we sing at the end, are not really part of the Haggadah. You should really speak about the four sons. That's pretty important. We have to recite Baruch Hamokim Baruch Hu, Baruch Shenasun Tal Am Yisrael Baruch Hu. That paragraph is crucial. Before we speak about the four sons, so we say we are a blessing to God for giving us the Torah. It's absolutely crucial. The Mishnah tells us to recite the psukim. Arami Avirovi from Mikra Bikurim and give the running commentary of the rabbis blending the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah with the Torah Shebichsam. So these are the most important parts of the Haggadah. The four, again, just to review, the Kiddush, and then you have to say the four questions, Manishtana. You have to say, pick up the matzah and say, Holach manya, this is the matzah, this is the type of matzah that our forefathers ate in Egypt. So after the kiddush, you got to say Holach manya, then you got to say four questions, Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves, then you have to say Mitchilov de Avadazar Hayavisenu. You don't have to spend so much time on each makkah. Had four parts, had five parts, had 250 makkahs. That if you really want to leave that out, that you can leave out. You have to say Baruch HaMokam Baruch Hu. You have to say the first half of Hal, the second half of Hal, the Baruch at the conclusion of the second half of Hal. These are all crucial. That's the main part. And reciting of the Psukim Arami Avadavi with the commentary of the Torah Shemal Peh. These are indispensable that you have to say. And if the people don't understand Hebrew, make sure that you recite it in translation so they'll understand.
I hope that our friend received his answer. And again, if there's a need for any further clarification, everyone listening, please do feel free to email to me, safranee@ou.org, and you'll get the answers and so forth. It's very gratifying. Just got a whole batch of questions that came in the last several minutes. We'll try to get to them, but if not, please do email back, and we will get you the response. Rabelsky, along the lines of what we were talking about, this person has a very specific question. I am a diabetic and cannot drink very much wine without really adversely affecting my blood sugars. Exactly how much wine do I have to drink for the four cups? What is the absolute minimum I can drink and still fulfill the mitzvah?
The absolute minimum, like we said, is a roiv of a revius. And even if you take the smallest revius, it's three ounces, so roiv would be 1.5 plus a little drop more. And he could find wine which has hardly any sugar. They sell, you know, these very dry wines, and there's almost no sugar there. And again, he should consult with his doctor, because if that's too much, it will affect his health adversely, then he shouldn't do it. There's no Yehorig Valyavar when it comes to drinking the four kosos. Some people are extremely sensitive and allergic to certain kind of things, so they, if they have to, they surely should consult with a doctor, a doctor who Shomer Torah Mitzvos and, you know, has an appreciation for the importance.
Shomer Torah Mitzvos means Sabbath observant, observant of mitzvos.
Right.
I'm saying that because this same person sent another email and says, thank you for the translations. Very much appreciated. So she also asks, Rav Shechter, we live in a home outside of a community, so we also have a Shabbos apartment we go to every weekend. I understand we will have to check both places since we won't be leaving the apartment more than 30 days before Pesach. Due to family coming in and not enough room in the apartment, we're going to have to stay in our house, although we will be going to the apartment for Shabbos Chol HaMoed. My question is, when do we check the apartment? There's absolutely no way we would have time to do it Sunday night. Can we do it the previous week or on Motzoi Shabbos if we're there then?
If it's much too difficult to check on Sunday night at both apartments, so you check on Motzoi Shabbos, so you check on Thursday night, and when one does the Bedikas Chametz prior to Sunday night, so the bracha is not recited.
Also, I will be doing all my cooking at the house and just bringing already prepared food to the apartment for Shabbos Chol HaMoed using paper plates and plastic silverware. I will put a Pesach tablecloth on the table and paper the shelves in the refrigerator. But do I also have to cover the counters thoroughly there? Do I have to run the self-cleaning oven if I'm not using it over Pesach? What exactly do I need to do there?
If one is not using the oven, you don't have to kasher the oven. You just leave it alone. The countertops, if you wash them off, if you're not going to put hot food on the countertop, you're just going to put everything on a plate, then there's no need to go crazy over the countertop. You don't have to kasher it.
Rabelsky, this question I saw also asked in other websites that are dealing with the Pesach. The first of the Dalet Kashas, the first of the four questions say, on all other nights we may eat bread and matzah, tonight only matzah. If that's the case, why then do some have the custom of not eating matzah between Purim and Pesach?
Okay, that's a fair question. But Some have the custom of not eating matzah, starting from Rosh Chodesh Nissan, there are various customs. But one may eat matzah which is not fit for Pesach, like egg matzah, or the Marsha says even matzah which was not made lishmo. One could eat, which, since you can't be yoitza with the mitzvah, but it's immaterial. You're allowed to eat matzah. It's only a custom. There's no iser if you have no other food, even if you have that custom. You're allowed to eat the matzah anytime. And if you have chametz tikka matzah, so which is openly chametz, or crackers, the type of food which is technically fit to be called matzah, you eat all the time. That's really what it means. Since we mentioned this, I'd like to throw in again something. There's a part of the Haggadah which says, if you don't say these three things, so you're not mekayim the mitzvah. And he says, Pesach matzah mor. And people tell me that in many homes, you know, they call everyone in. That's the women who are busy taking care of the babies, preparing the food for the upcoming meal, and so on. Everybody got to come in and recite together in a loud voice, Pesach matzah mor. And why is it necessary to say these three things? I don't believe that the Gamliel attached any importance to say these three words, any importance at all. What the Gamliel is telling us is the most simple thing people always ask. The children asked four questions, and we gave them all kinds of drushes. We said this shita and that shita. We spoke about Harami Ovidovi. And we said an entire Haggadah. But where did we answer the four questions? After all, it's a question deserves an answer. You're not allowed to have a child ask a question and not give him an answer. So if he asked these important questions, why don't we answer them? The answer to that question is that we do answer the four questions. And Rav Gamliel is giving us the answer. Child asks, why do we need matzah? So Gamliel said, now at the end, with the ample introduction and explanation of what Pesach is all about, so now we could answer the questions. Matzah zu shanu oichlen al shemo, and mor zeh shanu oichlen, and one of the four questions, which the most important question in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, was a question that lamentably we can't even ask today, is how come we eat this roasted meat, which is called Korban Pesach? Which we hope perhaps this year we'll have a Korban Pesach in Yerushalayim. And the answer to that question is, the answer is, Zevach Pesach u'Lashem, this is a Korban Pesach because of such and such. And then we even answer the question as to why we lean and why we dip our food twice. And the answer to that is because we're showing that we've been a chayyur. So these are the answers to the four questions. And if we don't say that, then we'll have given a wonderful, beautiful hakdama, in fact, which is so important. Chazal required practically everything, and at least most of it, to be said, half of it, whatever. But the Hakdama is just a preface. It's in preparation for the real answer. And the real answer is, therefore, we eat matzah and we eat mora, and all the questions that you ask, my child, I'm going to give you the answer to. And if a child is smart enough to ask, but we do eat matzah only 10 and a half months a year, or 11 or 11 and a half, but we don't eat matzah the whole year. Oh, wonderful. Yeah, a child who's so observant and sees everything and asks, you know, you got a real chacham on your hands, and Baruch Hashem for that.
This gentleman here already asks a follow-up question to something that was answered. He says, I'm going away for Pesach. I'm not selling my apartment. So I will make a bedika matzoi Shabbos, as was mentioned.
Good for him.
But even if I still have chometz, I will have sold the chometz. So what am I looking for, Rebelsky?
Well, there are two things we're talking about selling. Even if you sell the chometz, first of all, you still have to make bedikas chometz. If you sell the little pieces of chometz all over the house, because unless you really do something rash, you'll end up eating it, because if the person that wants to travel and not make bedikas chometz has to sell the apartment, not just the chometz. It's the person who owns or rents the apartment that's mechuyev in the bedikah. But if I own a house and I use it the whole year, and it's a mokum shemachnis, and I bring chometz in there, so what if I sold the chometz? I still have to be boidik chometz. It's chometz shel akum beveser shel yisroel. It has to be locked up, or it has to be sold along with the rental of the closet where the chometz is found. So it should be, it's chometz shel akum beveser shel akum beshuser shel akum. Chometz belonging to a non-Jew in an area that's owned by a non-Jew. So then it's not mine to be boidik. But you really have to examine the place where you live unless you do that. And people do that when they're desperate, when they have no choice, they're old, sick, or whatever it is. But like we said earlier, they really should be boidik chometz.
Another question that just came in, Rav Shechter. If one finds chometz on Pesach, does he burn it? Is it considered stealing from the goy that it was sold to?
We usually have in mind to sell the chametz that we designate. We're there, the chametz that's in this closet, the chametz that's in that closet. The chametz, you find a candy bar and below the sofa or something, we didn't really have in mind to sell that chametz to the non-Jew. So we should really destroy it, burn it.
When we get to working on Chol HaMoed, Rav Shechter, how do I judge the appropriateness of going to work on Chol HaMoed? Does the nature of the job factor in?
Nature of the job certainly does factor in. Chol HaMoed is not the same as Yontif, which in turn is not the same as Shabbos, but still you're not allowed to go to work. So one kula is if you won't go to work on Chol HaMoed, you may lose your job. So that's one would be lenient about that. You're allowed to go to work on Chol HaMoed. Even if you may lose your job, a suffix, you may, still, you're allowed to go to work. If your work consists of tzarchei rabbin...
You may lose the job literally, or perhaps thought of less so by the bosses. This fellow is taking off all these long days.
Also, if the boss will look poorly at me, and he may not give me a proper promotion... In the company also not. It's a problem. I should explain in advance why I can't come in a Chol HaMoed. Or if a person is engaged, let's say here in the office of the Orthodox Union, so some of the people do work on kashrus, which is crucial. They have to be here every single week. So that's tzorchei rabbim, or let's say so the secretary in a shul. Or there are things that are done for the benefit of the whole Jewish community. So those kind of things you're allowed to do on Chol HaMoed. But the malachas person goes to the office just to make money, to invest and to make money. So that kind of work you shouldn't do on Chol HaMoed.
You mean that office or business or store,
right?
All the same.
If you close your store on Chol HaMoed, then you lose all of your customers, and a lot of people won't come back after. If you don't come on Chol HaMoed, so they won't come after Chol HaMoed. So then that's davar ha'avit. So then you're allowed to keep the shop open. Well, you should try to keep fewer hours at least. It's not necessary to keep open all day Chol HaMoed. And if you can close your shop and close your business and you won't lose, you lose the income that you won't be getting on Chol HaMoed. But if you won't lose the customers permanently, then the correct thing should be not to go to work on Chol HaMoed.
Rebelsky, this is a little bit of a different kind of a question, but I guess it's real out there in the real world. I often take non-Jewish workers that I supervise out to lunch at a non-kosher restaurant. I will not eat anything, but there is chametz there. Is there any problem?
There's definitely a problem. I'm allowed to have goyim who work for me eat chametz. There's no problem with that. But if I bring them to a place which sells chametz, So I'm having hanoah. I'm enjoying the benefit of the chometz by providing chometz food for my non-Jewish workers or non-Jewish guests or clients or whoever it is that I want to please by bringing him this food. There's very little food out there that's osur b'hanoah that you can't enjoy the benefit of. Most is only osur b'achila. But there's still, and this is chayre, in non-kosher foods, and the halachas are very complicated. But since you didn't include them in your question, so I won't address it. But on Pesach, by providing chometz and by bringing them together with me paying for it or without me paying for it, I'm still providing a service for my non-Jewish workers, so I shouldn't take them to a place that's...
So in other words, Rebbe is saying that my taking them out and feeling good about their coming with me is also a type of hanoah.
Definitely. But if the guy goes to the trefna restaurant or even to a chometz restaurant and he buys his non-kosher food or his chometz on his own and I pay the bill, that's nothing because I'm not from the chometz, I'm not benefiting from it. I'm paying the salary to my worker. And there's really no difference if I order the food or if... But I shouldn't be ordering the food for him. I'm sorry, I have to modify that. I shouldn't be ordering the food for the non-Jewish worker on if I'm going to provide him with chometz. And in many cases, if I'll provide him with non-kosher food. I can't provide people, goyish workers or clients or associates with food which is also b'hanoah, which you can't enjoy it, benefits of, or with food that which shouldn't be eaten. A little slightly different rules for the two categories. But what they buy themselves, I definitely could pay the bill for.
But in this case, I am ordering it for them. They're my guests.
Yeah.
I imagine that they feel very good that the boss is taking them out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's a hanoah.
Yeah, that's hanoah. And there's also, there may be, in most cases, and this is chayre as well as hanoah, to do business with non-kosher food.
Okay. I think Shaila, a little bit related to that, Ravelsky, is if a non-Jewish co-worker presents me with a gift basket containing chometz for a job well done at the completion, let's say, of a certain project, is there a way I can take it without violating any prohibitions, any isurim?
If he gives it to me on Pesach, no way. Of course, how could I take chometz on Pesach from him? If he gives it to me after Pesach, and it's for a job that I did on Pesach, I'm not being nana from the chometz, I'm not benefiting, enjoying the chometz on Pesach. It's after Pesach. He could give me a present. But if I arrange that for my work, he'll provide me with chometz after Pesach. Then, while I'm doing the work, I'm spending the effort on getting myself the chometz, which I'll eat after Pesach. A person shouldn't do that.
Relating to wine, someone just asked the question, is it better to use wine that is not mevushal? And if yes, does one have to be careful that enochi not touch it?
Well, definitely.
Is it preferable to use a wine that's not mevushal?
See, there are certain shittas and opinions in the great commentaries that you're showing them, which add to the requirements what the preferences that one looks for when they're using wine for a mitzvah. Okay, one is to have red wine for the Seder. That's the Ramban, he says that if you have to have red wine for the Seder. The other is to have wine that has no sugar added. That's the Rambam who says so. And the Rambam also says that you can't have cooked wine. Now, we don't paskin l'chatchila like all of these. You could have wine which is white wine if you enjoy it, and with sugar added, and it could be cooked. But preferably, we try to satisfy these opinions, the extremely important opinions, and if we can, and if we're able to enjoy the wine and drink it and feel that cheres, that freedom, that excitement, and joy that we're supposed to be feeling during Pesach, so we should try all three.
Being that there are many, many of Chenu B'nai Yisrael who extend themselves and invite all sorts of Chenu B'nai Yisrael to come to the Seder, and there are the Azvaras about Yayin Mevushal and so forth, so isn't it better lechatchila to avoid the issues of Yayin She'eino Mevushal?
Definitely, if one has people at the Seder who will cause a problem if by having Yayin She'eino Mevushal, so then he should have Yayin Mevushal. And look, if you make be makar of people and get them closer to Yiddishkeit by showing them and teaching them the
beautiful Seder
and all that, so definitely provide them with Yayin She'eino Mevushal. With Yayin Mevushal, I'm sorry.
Yes, Rav Shechter, I think broadening the base on these kinds of issues, the following question came in. I follow the Pesach rules. My daughter and her family do not. She's due to give birth the beginning of April. My wife and I will be there possibly through Pesach. I will bring food, matzah, and all the other Passover foods that I need. I will also bring a Passover pot and pan, as well as paper dishes. If I cook on her stove, does that make my pot and the food in it chometz? If not, are the pot and pans now treif?
Should be with mazel. Your daughter should have a baby. Everyone should be healthy. Does it make the pot treif? I don't think so. If you have a burner, if you have a metal burner and the metal pot is sitting on top of it, so if there's no liquid in between the burner and the pot, so we assume that the non-kosher treife or the chometz dikah blia, the absorbed flavor that may possibly be in the burner if a piece of spaghetti fell on the burner, so we assume that the flavor doesn't go from one pot to the other, from one piece of metal to the other, if there's no moisture in between. If you're afraid that something may spill over, and you will have moisture in between, sometimes people are not that careful, things do spill. So look, if you can wrap up the prongs of the burner with tinfoil, then even if something will spill over, the burner, the metal of the burner, the prongs are not going to be touching the bottom of the pot. Strictly speaking, even if something would spill over, the chometz that was absorbed, the spaghetti that fell on the burner, probably fell a few days ago. Like the non-kosher, let's say there was some non-kosher meat that fell on the burner. So after 24 hours, the non-kosher meat certainly does not make treif your pot. That's not a question. The chometz that may be absorbed, the spaghetti that may be absorbed, there's a dispute if 24 hours went by since the chometz was absorbed into the burner. So then there's a dispute whether that can make treif in the middle of Pesach. On Erev Pesach will certainly not make treif. If you're cooking on the burner on Erev Pesach, cooking on the burner on Pesach, so Ashkenazim are, if you're an Ashkenaz family, so Ashkenazim are strict about that. And they would consider, that's called Eina Ben Yomo, the chometz that was absorbed in the burner, was more than 24 hours ago, so we would be machma that would go through, that can make the pot chometz stick. But again, you can put on tinfoil covering the prongs of the burner, or you may want to kasha the burner. If you hold, if you turn the prongs, pick up the burner, put it upside down, you put it into the fire, and you burn it out for a while till it's burning red, red hot. So then you've kashed the burners. So there is no chametz to speak of.
A question came in today that really wasn't one of our three subjects, but mipnei kavodo of the shoel. I will present the shaila to Rav Belsky. I do recall vividly, Rav Belsky, that you discussed this at length. Previous webcast, kosher in the home, and so forth. So, if you can respond to this gentleman, Bekitzer, I have two ovens, one on top of the other, and they share a vent. I kasher the top one for Pesach. Can I use them simultaneously, as I would like to prepare many items in the days before Pesach, while the lower oven is heating up pizza or cooking tonight's supper? If that is a problem, may I even use the Pesach oven when the lower oven, the chametz oven, is off? Do I have to wait until it cools down before I start up the Pesach oven?
As far as we could tell, nothing from the lower oven ever goes into the upper oven. It goes through the vent, and what goes through the vent is just heated air. And there's no steam and odor or anything that could possibly carry the taste or the smell of something that's also that's forbidden for use. It just goes by a tube, a chimney, and it doesn't enter the oven. It doesn't affect it whatsoever. Everyone who studied the ovens, which are very common and popular today, the two ovens, one on top of the other, came to the same conclusion. That's what I feel is the prevailing opinion.
And therefore, one can use the top one for Pesach.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bottom one, he can warm up his Thursday evening pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, I want to reiterate, any shilas that we will not answer or other shilas that come up subsequent to the webcast throughout the week, please feel free to email to me, safranee@ou.org, and as in the past, we will, Emir Hashem, try to get you the answers as soon as possible, Bli Neder. Rav Shechter, is there a problem if I notice the delectable scent of a goy's chametz at the office?
Chametz may not eat chametz, one may not gain any benefit from chametz. On the Shulchan Aruch it says you shouldn't walk near the non-Jewish bakery on Pesach in the street in order to smell the pleasant aroma of the freshly baked bread or cake or cookies or something, because that too is a form of gaining pleasure. You get hanor from smelling. If a person is minding his own business and he happens to smell something, chametzdik, that has a pleasant aroma, and he's not really interested in it, strictly speaking, that's not a violation of getting hanor from the chametz. But
He doesn't have to walk out, does he?
Does not have to walk out, no. If he's doing his work, minding his own business, and he happens to smell some pleasant smell of chametz, he doesn't have to walk out. I remember I used to live in the summertime. I used to visit by my aunt and uncle in Massachusetts. So when the next neighbor would be cooking their meat, so my uncle would always scream, "Kids, come out of the backyard, you're smelling basar b'chalav." He assumed that the next neighbor was cooking their meat with milk, and basar b'chalav, meat that was cooked with milk, he may not only not allowed to eat it, you're not allowed to gain pleasure from it. So that was a big chumrah. My uncle was a big tzaddik. But strictly speaking, if we're playing, we're minding our own business and happens to have a pleasant smell, that's not a violation of getting hanor.
Rav Belsky, I would appreciate some clarity on keeping flour over Pesach. I remember hearing from a Yorub Shayid that in his time, matzah was made from common flour.
But today, all flour is tempered, which means to say that before they grind the wheat and turn it into flour, they soak the wheat kernels in water, and we assume there's chametz there. You have to have special grinding in order to get yourself some flour from wheat that's not tempered, in other words, not soaked. So we assume there's no kamach min hashuk, there's no flour from the marketplace which could be used b'shas hadchak, if you're under pressure, to be used for matzahs. It's all chametz. But I'm asked very often about people who have the minig not to sell chametz, and regular chametz. Should we say that all that flour is complete chametz? It's hard to say that, because even if they soak it for the amount of time, which is, of course, most suitable for what they need, they drain it, they dry it very quickly, and they grind it, and we see practically no effect. It's completely dry, and so we have to assume there's a little bit chametz in there. So it's a tarovitz chometz at worst. Of course, it's also to eat on Pesach.
Well, it can certainly be sold.
It can certainly be sold, yeah.
Okay, we want to pay our attention to some of the questions that came in about vitamins, medicines, not edibles. Certainly, these are very important to the people that ask the questions and others. Rav Schechter, is it okay to take Bistalic on Pesach? Bistalic is an FDA-approved high blood pressure pill.
I would assume it is okay. What does it taste like? It probably is not even edible. If you have pills that don't taste good, so if you have a loaf of bread that's spoiled and it's awful, it's nifsal me'achilas hakelev, even a dog wouldn't want to eat it, but I sit and I eat it, so I demonstrate that as far as I'm concerned, it is royal achila, so that's prohibited mid'rabbanan. But if you have just a pill that's not edible, and I take it for medicinal purposes. So that, I'm not demonstrating that, that as far as I'm concerned, it's Roy Lachila. Pill is a pill. We assume it's okay.
Ravelsky, you want to comment about Triaminic, which fortunately is OU certified. Is it kosher for Pesach?
I understand that Triaminic makes a product called fever reducer, which is kosher for Pesach. Now, you see, there are certain sweeteners that are made from chometz. There's a common sweetener used in medicines and other food products, which is called maltitol. Maltitol has chometz in it very often. Sorbitol, the same thing. It's also a sweetener. It has chometz in it. But if you check the ingredients and you don't see maltitol or sorbitol, then you know that it's acceptable for Pesach. Of course, it has to have hashgacha because it's a food. These cough medicines very often, I can't say for all of them, but very commonly, they're sweetened and made into pleasant type of food. But if there's nothing in there that's chometz, that shouldn't be a problem. That's what the OU feels after having examined this product, and they could, contrary to other product, even though the other products are edible and may present problems, but you know, no one really examined them, but Triaminic, Baruch Hashem, is under the hashgacha, the oversight of the OU, and we know it's there, and the stuff that doesn't have maltitol or sorbitol is acceptable for Pesach.
For our listeners, I bring to your attention once again the OU kosher tidbits. Among the just about 170 that are posted is a very important tidbit from Rav Belsky, in which he discusses at length issues of kashrus relating to medicines. And while I'm at it, I want to laud and applaud the Novartis Consumer Health Company for having certified, together with the Orthodox Union, their Triaminic cough syrups. And we look forward to many other pharmaceuticals, over-the-counter pharmaceuticals, to become OU certified in the future as well. Ravelsky, regarding Tylenol, Advil, Motrin, and the like, does it need a hashgacha for Pesach? And if Ravelsky wants to discuss for a minute, pills versus liquid.
Yeah, well, pills generally are no problem because they're bitter, and there's no such thing as achshave. It's not considered like you turned it into a food. Like Avshachta mentioned earlier, but Tylenol, but especially Advil, the pills are coated with all kinds of things, which of course are totally unnecessary for the medicinal benefit. I looked at the long list of additives used to coat the pill with various flavors and gelatins and glycerins, who knows what. Why they add them, I guess, to outsell the competitor, probably. But whatever it is, you got to keep away. Take a bitter pill, it's not the end of the world, unless a person looks forward to being sick his whole life. Hopefully these, I don't know, that's not like, diabetes pills and such pills which are for chronic conditions that you got to keep taking.
You mean prescription medications?
Yeah, the Tylenol, the Advil, the Motrin, they're there for an emergency when there's a high fever and some other kind of thing when you have a lot of pain. And it says never take too many of them. So those pills don't do a service to us because they're so sweet, but some of these are very sweet. A liquid is even worse. A liquid has additives to make it still sweeter and pleasant. One of the most common additives that make it pleasant is the glycerin. Now, half the glycerin in the country is TAF. It's taken from beef fat and from pig fat and such kind of foods. It could also be taken from petroleum. It could be derived from vegetable fat. But it's all mixed together, and most of the glycerin that's commonly used has kosher and non-kosher ingredients. It's just plain the same thing. Chemically, it's the same idea. The glycerin is the base of every fat or fatty type of material.
So the Mascona regarding these commonly known over-the-counter pharmaceuticals such as Tylenol, Advil, and Motrin, what should one do if they need?
If it's a pill and it has no exceptionally sweet coating, so then go ahead and take it if you need it, and follow the rules. Don't take too much of it. If it's a pill that's very very sweet, I would try to find some substitute.
Does the average consumer actually feel when they take an Advil whether or not there's a sweet coating to it?
Well, I don't read the ingredients that much, you know. But one time I had to get Advil for someone, and they told me that it's exceptionally sweet. So I read the ingredients, and I saw these kind of things there. So there are others. The Advil is a trade name for a chemical called ibuprofen.
Ibuprofen, yes.
And if you go into the drugstore and you ask them for generic ibuprofen, it'll cost you a quarter as much, and it also doesn't have these coatings on it. Mm-hmm. So you get the same, it's exactly the same thing, by the way. When doctors tell you that this brand is so much more effective, that's all fantasy. Now, liquids, of course, is a problem. Chewables also, although I don't know, you know, it's a tiny amount of sweetener and flavor that's added to the chewables. So that's debatable whether that makes the whole pill awesome. But the cough syrups or the liquids, they're usually the sweetness is part of the medication. You have a throat that's burning with pain, and having that smooth, tasty liquid to run down the sides of your throat is very helpful in accomplishing the purpose and taking away the pain. So it definitely is something to be wary of. I have, I've seen publications where someone said, printed, that glycerin is such a horribly tasting, it's a horribly tasting material that it doesn't have to be kosher, and so on. So I keep in my desk a bottle of glycerin with a hechsher, kosher glycerin. And in case anybody comes up with that tidbit, let's call it non-kosher tidbit. So,
not posted in OU tidbits.
And, posted in OU that you shouldn't use it. It's as sweet and delectable and tasty as anything you ever tasted. So you've got to be careful when it comes to edibles. But bitter pills and the generic stuff that doesn't have all those, that candy coating, there's no problem at all.
Rav Schechter, should each child over bar mitzvah be given 3 whole matzahs, or can we just give them the shear from the broken matzah of the father who leads the Seder?
The Talmud presents a dispute about that, and the Talmud comes to the conclusion that it's not necessary to give each participant in the Seder his own matzahs and his own mar. The one who's running the whole Seder, the father, the grandfather, whoever is in charge, will give matzah. Now, it's probably, if you have a broken matzah in the middle, and you have 5 people at the Seder, you're not going to have 5 kazesim in the broken matzah. So you have to add on more. So you have a box full of matzah. Some of them are broken, some of them are whole. So when the father, who's the grandfather, who's in charge of the whole Seder, is about to say Hamotzi al-achilas matzah, he should add on a lot of broken matzahs in the middle. So not just 2.5 matzahs. He should have 2 matzahs that are not broken and have a lot of broken matzahs in the middle. So he'll be able to give everybody a kazayis from broken matzah. He has to have a lot of shleimus also. He has to have a lot of matzahs that are not broken. He'll be able to give everybody kazayis when they're not broken matzahs.
A number of questions came in regarding toothpaste. One even just a few moments ago, out in the Midwest, we don't have any access to kosher Pesach toothpaste and mouthwash. Can we use any of the regular brands? Rav Schechter, there are also other questions that came in regarding toothpaste. What do we tell our people?
There is a toothpaste that has a hashgacha. Tom's of Maine has a hashgacha. It'll be kosher Pesach, but if that's available. Strictly speaking, the toothpaste is not edible also, so strictly speaking, it doesn't really need a hashgach. I live in Washington Heights, so there Rabbi Breuer used to be the rabbi there years ago, so they all tell the story that when Adwi first started producing the kosher Pesach toothpaste, so they came to the old Rabbi Breuer, Zechon Levracha, they wanted him to give a hashgacha. It should be under Breuer's hashgacha. So he didn't want to give a hashgacha. He thought that they wouldn't last too long. He thought they would go out of business. And they would remember that Rabbi Breuer gave a hashgacha on a toothpaste, and people would think you're not allowed to use toothpaste if it doesn't have a hashgacha. And next year they'll be brushing their teeth without any toothpaste. So on principle, he refused to give a hashgacha. So strictly speaking, you don't need a hashgacha. Baruch Hashem, you have hashgach. If you have, it's even better. So if you have the opportunity to use this Tams of Maine, fine. It has no chametz, just has an issue of kidneys in it. So that we would be lenient on. But if you don't have kosher toothpaste available, so you can use any toothpaste.
And also, Rav Schechter, can one take vitamins in Pesach? Is there a difference between chewable and pills?
Chewable vitamins, you're going to have the issue that Rabbi Belsky mentioned before, that they add on flavors. Some of the flavors may be treif for all year long. Some of the flavors may be chametzik for Pesach. If it's not chewable, if it's just a vitamin that you swallow and it doesn't have any flavoring on the coating on the outside, it tastes bitter. If you put it on your tongue, it tastes bitter. So then, strictly speaking, it's not royal achila. Not royal achila sakelev. A dog wouldn't eat it. It's not royal achilas art and people wouldn't eat it. So it's, strictly speaking, is permissible even if it has chametz, even if it has treifus. To sit and pop one after the other into your mouth, to have a whole bottle full of them, to fill yourself up, that would be considered achshavi. I'm demonstrating that as far as I'm concerned, it's royal achila. But you don't take 500 pills. You take one pill a day. You take one pill every 10 hours or something. So there is no achshavi. You're not demonstrating that it's still royal achila. So that would be permissible.
Okay. Again, this question is also not one of our three major topics, but a number of people have sent it in, and I also saw it discussed on other rabbinic websites. And most important, one of the questions came in, says, Rav Belsky, this is from your daughter. So das Avada darf man fragen. There's an argument among rabbis, if you have a granite countertop that you put on hot challah and so forth, can you kosher it using a hot steamer? If not, how should you kosher these countertops? A number came in as follows. Another question came in about 3:00, and Ravelsky discussed the use of a hot steam cleaner to kosher granite countertops. I've heard that one can go over the same spot twice to kosher, first to create a layer of condensation and then to boil it up on the surface by going over it a second time.
Yeah, well, there are ways of kashering countertops, which are mentioned in Poiskim, and that is common use in kashering hotels and restaurants and all these things. And that is to take boiling water and pour it all over, and at the same time, Kavan Heaven Mulbenes, a stone that was heated, or the kosher caterers use a brick. It keeps a lot of heat inside, and have that go along with the stream of boiling water, and that's called Iri together with Evan Mulbenes. Iri means a stream of boiling water. Someone came up with this steam shooter, a steam jenny, they call it, which would be wonderful, but you have to make certain that the steam is really hot. Steam is not necessarily boiling. Steam is not water vapor, which exists only above 212. Steam is condensed water vapor. If you go out in the winter and take a, exhale into the air, you'll find plenty of steam coming out of your mouth. And it's ice cold. So you have to make sure that the stuff coming out of the steam jenny is really boiling hot. If it's so, then you could kasher that countertop. And it's true what was said before, there are Moshe Zatzal said that if the steam will cause the condensed water on the surface to boil up, so then you'll have more than just steam, you'll have actual boiling water on the surface because there is water there from the first application of steam. Now, others raise an issue that the common granite countertops that are in use today are really not granite at all. It's not that they go to some mountain and chop out a slab of granite, which is equal to the size, shape, and form to your countertop that you desire, but it's chopped up granite which is glued together, so there's glue all over the place running through between the pieces of granite. So you probably could kasher the hardened glue as well. The issue of new materials, could they be kashered? Are they like a klicheres, which can't be kashered, or are they like classical materials outside of a klicheres, which could be kashered? Most opinions hold that it's acceptable to kasher such a kind of thing. The only thing I tell people is, after all that work in kashering the granite countertop, you probably paid a lot of money and are all psyched up, to kasher it, but just think, what are you going to do? Walk into a kitchen which doesn't look Pesachtik? After all, a Pesach kitchen is covered and taped up and all kinds of things. So you might want to kasher it just for that reason too, or cover it. But if it's kashered properly, yes, you could do it. I'm sure that some of the methods that I mentioned, though, about using an Evan Mulbenes and using Iri and doing it in combination, they're probably beyond the abilities of the average householder who wouldn't be able to do that. And they're afraid of holding a brick that was laying in a fire for 20 minutes and in the other hand hold a tea kettle filled with boiling water and move up and down with the two of them. They're probably scared stiff to do such a kind of thing. And we have a klal, a rule in kashering things, that if you're afraid to use it, if you're afraid that the material will warp, or if you're afraid that to apply it, because you yourself are afraid, you don't want to do it for more than a split second, you're filled with a tremendous fear of that terrible fire coming out of the propane torch or whatever it is that you're using. So, it's highest all of Duma Poka. You're not going to make a good kashi. If you have someone, though, who's used to doing these things, and they work for caterers and the mashkichim, and they do it all the time, is fine and dandy if you want to take a training session and have, you know, practice doing the same thing. It's fine.
So, Lamaisa, what should the housewife do in regard to these granite countertops?
Well, they
cover
might.
Them?
I would say they should pour boiling water over them, clean them up real well, and cover them like they do every year. But if they want to show their granite countertop off to everyone, so they could do it a whole year long, and for 8 days till the show will be in abeyance, you know, pause.
Okay, Rav Shechter, these questions just came in. We want to wind up in a few moments. I work for a firm which is owned by a partnership comprised of Jews and non-Jews. Is there a concern regarding Chomesh Avraham Pesach for food found in the cafeteria and which is provided by the firm? Obviously, we assume all the food is kosher.
I would assume there is a problem. If the firm is owned by Shutfis partnership, Jews and non-Jews together, so and the Jews didn't sell their share in the chametz in the cafeteria, then you have a problem of chametz shavuot of Pesach, yes?
Need one be concerned about chametz shavuot of Pesach when it comes to food in vending machines, in offices, and other public buildings which are of unknown ownership?
I would assume that many of these vending machines probably are stuffed by Jewish owners, yeah. Some of them will not be selling the chametz. Sure, you should have a concern. Should try to find out who is the owner of the chametz.
Is whole wheat matzah considered to be as mehudar as regular white flour matzah of Shechter?
Sure it is. Exact same thing.
Cool. Okay, there's no pre-Pesach webcast at OU without quinoa. I do recall very vividly that Rav Belsky discussed it at very great length in a previous webcast. Ayin Sham, all of the webcasts are posted on the OU website. But Rav Belsky, Bekitzer Nimratz, quinoa, permissible for Pesach or not?
You know, there are various opinions about quinoa. It's a new material. And I felt that, and I still feel, that quinoa shouldn't be used on Pesach. And the reason being that in the countries where quinoa is a regular food, they grind it up and make a flour, they make bread from it and cookies and cakes. They use it very much in a similar way to wheat, and that's one of the main reasons for kidney is. Is it harvested and cleaned and processed in the same exact manner as certain beans? Perhaps not. But today, you know, people are in the mood of discovering kidneys all over the place. They say that linseed and cottonseed, they think like that, l'cholapos, at least, quinoa is, you know, processed at least similarly to wheat as cottonseed is. Nobody seems to be disturbed. They call it kidneys. And quinoa is used as a flour and as a bread base. I don't see why a person who feels that without quinoa he'll die from all kinds of diseases because it's the only healthy food in the world. I think for 1 week of not eating quinoa, he'll survive.
Rav Shechter, is the OU generally allowing kidneys to nishtanu? Is that OU policy?
Strictly speaking, we allow it. We try to avoid it, but if you can't avoid it, so strictly speaking, we will allow it. Kidney shenishtana means if it underwent a major change and is a totally different chemical composition now. So
for
if
example?
An example, sorbitol, I think, maybe a totally different shinoi. If it starts off as corn syrup, which is shemen kidneys, and then you have an enzyme to convert that, I think, into sorbitol or something. So that would probably be considered kidney shenishtanu because it's a major change. We wouldn't permit nishtanu on something that's osa b'achila min haTorah. We wouldn't permit it l'chatchila on something that's osa b'achila min derabbanan either. The Mishnah Berurah quotes the Prima Gadim that if you got stuck, b'diyevet, so then we could be mekel. Ananisa de Rabbanu Shenishtana. But kidneys is only a minhok. It's not even an Anisa de Rabbanu, so we observe it. But be machmer on kidneys Shenishtanu, That's already much, because even in Issa d'Rabbanan, that's nishtana, that's totally changed. Strictly speaking, the Mishnah Berurah says it's mutar b'dieved. So kitya shenishtana, we would even permit it l'chatchila if he can't get a substitute, can't get something else.
Okay, it's gratifying that so many out there are listening. We already have some questions that have come in as a follow-up to some of the answers that were given. Rav Schechter, someone asked, I may have misunderstood Rav Schechter's answer. Does the father have to have all the matzah for all the participants in front of him when he makes the bracha, or can he give out the two kezesim to each participant and then make the bracha?
On Pesach night, like every Shabbos and Yom Tov, you want to have Lecha Mishnah, you want to have the two Shlemas. So Lecha Mishnah means that the people are, usually it means that people are eating at least a little bit from the Shlemas that the person is saying, Amoitzian. Same thing he's saying, I guess the Prusa doesn't make a difference. Alachilas Matzah, you can give everybody broken matzah, okay. But everybody has to have a little bit from the Shlema also. So we in Shulchan Aruch, the recommendation is that everyone, Rabbi Belsky mentioned earlier, the recommendation of Shulchan Aruch is that when you say Hamoitzi and Alachilas Matzah, everybody should eat two units of matzah, two kezaisim. One kezaisim is from the Shlema, and one kezaisim from the broken matzah from the Prusa. There are those who disagree. They think that one kezaisim is sufficient. So Rabbi Belsky explained before, if you're going to be machmir to have the big kezaisim, so it's twice as big as the normal kezaisim, they already have the two kezaisim. So for the kezayis of the broken matzah, for the prusa, so that everybody can have a broken matzah in front of him. But for the kezayis, for the lecha mishnah, for the shlema, that the one who's running the haggadah should have a lot of shlemas. Or you should give everybody their own lecha mishnah. Okay, when we have a lot of guests, so it's just too difficult for me to have all the shlemas. I tell each one of the fathers of the household, take your own matzahs and make your own lecha mishnah.
Rabelsky, I guess this also has to do with many of the printed guidebooks for Pesach. But someone just asked, may one use plasticware, cups, plates, cutlery, baking paper, etc.? Are they coated with chametz or kidneys? If yes, may they be used with cold only?
As far as we know, there is no coating of any kind of trefna material on any plastic paper in of any kind of artificial material. And it makes no difference whether you use it with hot or with cold. Styrofoam has an extraordinarily teeny amount of material which may have from non-kosher origin, and it migrates to the surface. We measured the amount that would end up inside of one cup of a drink inside a typical styrofoam cup. It's probably 2-3 parts or 4-5 parts, maybe, per million.
So is Ravelsky responding in general regarding kashrus?
No.
What about chametz?
Kashrus and chametz, whatever it is, there's nothing there. Chametz is never.
In
any of these. But kashrus, there may be 2, 3, 4, 5 parts per million that end up in a half a cup of liquid. And as far as I know, there's no difference between hot and cold. The hot doesn't cause the molecules to migrate to the surface, and it's just not there. It's bottled 1,000 times over, and besides which, someone once made a test as to the material that does migrate to the surface. It turns out that there's 95 parts out of 100 which are foul-tasting, but you don't even taste the foul taste because it's so tiny. Rabbi Farrell just pointed out to me that we do give a hashgacha in the OU on some special baking, cooking paper, parchment paper. There is parchment paper, Quillon, and that's a trade name. There's others, other brands.
That are certified.
That are certified, yeah. Those papers which are coated, they're not typical paper. They're not called paper plates or paper this, paper that, plastic. They're called by a special material. The entire purpose of that material is to have it lined with a what we call a release agent. A release agent means something that's going to cause the item that's being prepared not to stick to the mold or to the paper, and that's found all over the place. A release agent could be teif. I don't know if any of that's chometz, but definitely it could be non-kosher. And for that, you have to have hechsher.
Okay, I'm going to ask the last question. I believe that we covered most of the questions that were asked. Again, if your question was not responded to, please feel free to email to me at safran@ou.org, and in Mirza Shem, we will get you the responses from the poskim. The last question really also brings us back in memory to last year's last question, and I think it's very important that the Rosh Yeshiva comment on it, and that is, what should be the focus of the father at the Seder? Every year we buy new Haggadahs. I just bought a new Haggadah last week, and I saw that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was asked, V'igadata levincha, ki yishalcha bincha. So he was asked, if all of the children are already programmed, they come home with all their sheets and their machbarot and all their workbooks that their teachers and moros and rabbeim prepared for them, and they recite almost by rote all sorts of things that they heard, and everybody's supposed to shuffle out of nachas. And what happens to the father's role in using this night to motivate, to stimulate, to create a kind of environment that children will remember? Rav Schechter, you commented on it last year, even posted on websites that people had great hanoah from. You want to?
I think we tell our children, I was saying a sipra lono. I tell our children, I knew my grandparents, both sets of grandparents, from the father's side, from the mother's side. My grandparents knew their parents and their grandparents and so on all the way back. And our religion is based on historical tradition. And we know that all these things are true. It's not a religion that was witnessed by 11 people or 25 people. This is all of the nisim and the flaws of the Esemakis and the Kriyas Yamsuf, and everything was witnessed by millions and millions of people. There was Shishim Rebo. Our historical tradition is very strong. I was saying a Sipru Lono. And all of the nisim and the flaws of Yitzias Mitzrayim and Maimon Hasin, everything was witnessed by Shishim Reba, 600,000 Jewish men between the age of 20 and 60, and there were younger children and older adults and women, and there was Erev Rav Olam Yitam. There was a big mixture of Erev. There were several million people who witnessed all of this. So we tell over, this is our historical tradition. This is what our whole religion is based on. The Sipa Yetzias Mitzrayim and telling over about Maimon HaSinai are the two crucial historical events that form our religion. Everything is based on that.
Belsky? Well, we have people who are even more educated and know many times more than all our children could possibly know. In fact, we have a special story that we tell about by the Seder, which illustrates Kulon HaChachomim, Kulon HaNevoinim, Kulon HaZkenim, Kulon HaYodin HaSatorah, Maiseb, you know, about the holy Tanoim, who had twice as much to tell each other about Yetzias Mitzrayim, giving over the Sipur in such a way that creates an impression as if a person is actually there. Chayav Adam Liris Es Atzmai, a person should see himself that he left Mitzrayim. The Rambam puts it a little bit more colorfully. He says, Ki'ilu Ato Yotza Meshivat Mitzrayim, as if he's now going. He should feel that same excitement, that same personal experience. That's what we have to bring out. And, of course, one of the greatest testimonies to that is the fact that our children, Baruch Hashem, are able to repeat all the things that they're taught. Just the opposite. It adds to the happiness and to the experience of being able to portray our sitting at the Seder as if we were personally experiencing Yetzias Mitzrayim. And hopefully that's what we'll accomplish. We'll have that historical experience which will just put us into the present role as experiencing Yetzias Mitzrayim and Matan Torah right now. That's the tachlis. If one could accomplish that at his Seder, then he'll have accomplished everything that Chazal and that the Torah wanted us to do. Igalta Levincha is to make everything alive. Hopefully, Be'ez Hashem, we'll be able to do that and carry that preservation of the Torah and the continuity of the Torah, the values of the Torah and values that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us over, taught us, till the end of days.
Amen. A very, very big Yisher Koach to Rosh Yeshiva, to Rav Belsky, and to Rav Shechter. Special thanks again to my Chaverim, Rav Gerstein, and Rabbi Farrell. And as always, a very special thank you to our chief OUN radio engineer, Dan Jesselson, for his assistance and help and friendship. We hope all of you have gained from the questions and the answers and all of the Torah that we have learned together the past 2 hours. Hopefully by tomorrow the webcast will be posted on OU Web, on the homepage, as well as on www.oukosher.org. All the previous webcasts are also posted, both in Inyan Pesach and other webcasts that we have had. And we hope, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, that all of us together, individually and collectively, the Klal Yisrael will have a Chakosher V'Sameach, that we should be Zoche to the Nisim that our forefathers saw in Mitzrayim, B'Yameinu, B'Korov, and that all of us should be able to Sheb the Nachas that we anticipate from children and grandchildren, B'Simcha U'B'Nachas. Many, many thanks again. And I remind you, if there are questions that were not answered, please do feel free to email to us. We will respond. Thank you again.